So this afternoon, we're honored to have Sally Ady joining us. Sally Ady currently lives in New York and is a reporter at IEEE Spectrum magazine. Her current topics of focus are defense technology and solid-state physics. She is also a freelance science writer and contributes to publications like GeoTimes. Sally began her training as a writer as an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins University, where she majored in the Writing Seminars program, working under the tutelage of fiction writers like National Book Award winner Alice McDermott, as well as critical writers like Mark Crispin Miller. Several years after receiving her BA, Sally surprised her friends and family when she announced that she would be returning to Hopkins to take courses in math and physics, and eventually combined her interests in writing and science by joining the science writing program at Hopkins, where she worked under the advisement of noted science writer Anne Finkbeiner. So we are happy to have Sally join us today for a chat about science writing and about what it's like to be a professional writer and editor. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I was hoping you could start us off by telling us something about science writing. What is science writing? How is it different from other types of writing? How is it different from other types of journalism?
Okay, well, I'll start with other types of writing. So I guess broadly you can characterize writing into science writing, well, journalism, under which falls science writing, and academic writing and, you know, fiction and poetry. I guess science writing is certainly different from academic writing in that you kind of have to write in a way that pulls people along. A lot of times what you're writing about is something that somebody hasn't really thought about a lot during their day-to-day life, and you have to be able to present it in a style that compels them to keep reading. You have to try, anyway. And, you know, academic writing, I think, a lot of times is sort of written for a captive audience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're a student, you've been assigned the thing, or, not to make it sound like it's terribly written, it's just that people have a pre-existing interest and education in the material. It's different from fiction, obviously, because you're just not making stuff up out of thin air, even though sometimes that's what it feels like. And then you have to check with your sources, and they confirm or tell you that you're wrong. So, right.
So it seems like one thing that you're saying is that science writing requires that you have to work hard to engage your audience, which I imagine might be difficult, especially when you're writing on a topic that isn't accessible mm-hmm. to a lay audience.
Yeah.
So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how you try to write on complicated topics in a way that can be understood by lay people.
Well, there's three, I would say, again, separating it into three artificial categories. There's three different audiences that you're going to be writing for. You've mm-hmm. got, you know, your science magazine. You know, going in that these are scientists reading it. They're going to understand things that might be a little bit more esoteric, let's say, than a regular, you know, guy who's reading Time magazine in the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, like, Wired, which is people who are pretty educated but not necessarily scientists, but, you know, they try to keep plugged into things. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Time magazine where, you know, some guy picks it up in a doctor's office and there you are telling him about climate change. So I guess the three ways of writing for these audiences, you have to know who they are, mm-hmm. And you have to know that you can't get into as much detail, obviously, in Time magazine. You're not going to sit there and examine the intricacies of, like, a multi-gate transistor versus a planar transistor. Like, nobody's going to care. But in Science magazine, you may mm-hmm. be able to actually do it. The one commonality is, of course, you don't want to sort of get so wrapped up in your own nonsense that mm-hmm. you just keep droning on. You still have to continue to draw people along. Mm-hmm. Try.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the publications that you work for.
Okay.
So IEEE, Spectrum Magazine, GeoTimes, where do these publications fit in this three-tiered division between the knowledge of the audience members?
Well, GeoTimes, I would say, well, they're both actually not trade publications, but mm-hmm. Spectrum is the flagship magazine of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, or maybe it's the other way around. I'm glad this is going to be a podcast. As such, we talk to a wide-ranging audience. We need to appeal to the engineer that comes home after a long day of engineering and picks up his magazine and he wants to read something interesting, but also something that doesn't talk down to him. But we also need to appeal to, you know, her husband, who maybe he's a writer. Uh-huh. So we want to make sure that everybody is, even if they can't 100% understand what we're saying, that it's still interesting enough. Uh-huh. GeoTimes is for the American Geological Union, and that one's a little bit more broadly dispersed, I would say. So that one's a lot more accessible, I would say, the story content.
Let's go back to this issue of how science writing differs from other types of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that journalists worry about often is providing a certain amount of balance.
Mm-hmm.
Often reporters will write about public opinion, and then it's important to represent differing viewpoints. Now, when you're writing on science, where you're at least writing about something that claims to have absolute truth, how do you negotiate the need for balance and the need to respect the objective truth of science?
Okay, well, I'm going to go on about this, so if we run out of time, just stop me, make me shut up, because this is one of my favorite topics, actually. Obviously, there's been a lot of controversial topics out there that have been addressed in ways that... I'll back up. Traditionally, in journalism, you want to represent both sides of a controversy or whatever, any sides. Like, let's say there are three. Most of the time, in very politically loaded topics, it ends up boiling down to two sides, you know? And in normal journalism, you know, people have the sort of he said, she said, I'm clueless approach. So they sort of present what they call objectivity, but that's actually just, you know, a pretense of cluelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's not a pretense. Like, you know, some things, you know, you don't know anything about. You're reporting on some arcane bit of policy, so you don't know. And so you've got your two interest groups. Science writing, a lot of times science topics get hijacked by political entities that have interests on either side. So you end up, as a reporter, getting sort of tugged in many different directions. But the main thing that you have to remember as a science writer is that science is not a democracy. Science is not a democracy. This was said by, I forgot his name, Chris Mooney. He's an amazing science writer. He wrote an article for Columbia Journalism Review that I'm going to be plagiarizing a lot of right now, because he laid this out in great terms. You know, you've got your very controversial topics, of course. You've got your climate change, you've got your evolution, you've got your abortion causes breast cancer. But the one I'm going to talk about is UFOs, UFO abduction, because I think it, and, you know, he wrote about this, it really illustrates the sort of traps that journalists fall into, science journalists. So, on TV, one night, you're watching TV and you see Peter Jennings say, tonight we have, two guys who say that they were abducted by UFOs and probed sexually. And then you've got, you know, these two psychologists who explain it and say, well, you know, what happens is, you know, you go through the sleep paralysis, you've got REM sleep going, you know, you're in REM sleep and you're paralyzed, but you wake up, you're still half dreaming, you see what you think is, you know, a little green man, but you can't move. So this, they think, is what leads to not only, you know, the idea that you've been abducted by a UFO, but it goes all the way back to, like, succubi and incubi. It's a really interesting topic psychologically. But instead of sort of talking about that, what they do is they have, you know, the UFO guys on and the psychologist guys on, and you've got them at the end, the sort of moderator, you know, the guy who is supposed to be telling you what the story is, instead of sort of painting it as, well, this is a really interesting psychological problem, you've got him being like, do UFOs exist? Until next time. You know, it's like this Twilight Zone thing. And it's almost like a manufactured, it's a manufactured debate, because it's not really a debate. I mean, there's no UFOs. There's no UFOs. There are no little green men sexually probing you in your sleep. It's a really interesting thing that is, you know, sort of a, I apologize to any UFO enthusiasts out there, but, you know, so that is sort of the template for how scientists or science journalists try to inject artificial balance, because what happens is, you know, again, now let's go to climate change. You've got, you know, 10,000 scientists, you know, agree that X. 350, however, say that Y. And even just the wording of it is problematic, because it makes you think in terms of numbers. It's not about numbers. It's about replicating data. It's about being able to have an experiment and do it again, yielding the same results, and do it again, yielding the same results. It's about peer-reviewed journals. Now, as a science journalist, you can't do the he said, she said, I'm clueless thing. You have to, especially, we all have beats. Like, you know, I can't write about malaria. I write about, you know, microchips and, you know, defense technology. So in that sense, you know, I have a little bit of, I guess, an understanding of the field. I'm certainly not a scientist, but I know a little bit about what the trends are, what's going on. So, you know, if you're writing about climate science, you're probably like that too. You probably have some understanding of what's going on. So you have a responsibility to share with people who, you know, don't look at this every day. Hey, listen, I know that the preponderance of evidence tilts toward X. You know, Y may say this, but, you know, again, science is not a democracy. This is, that, you know, there are facts. Like, think about if, you know, like, think about in Galileo's time, if somebody had said, you know, well, you know, certain people think that the, you know, Earth is, you know, revolving around the sun, but, you know, common wisdom is that, you know, the sun revolves around the Earth. I mean, that's the same kind of, it's not a democracy. Mm-hmm. Have I said that enough?
Yeah. So, since you do write about defense technology, I imagine that there is a certain amount of politics that's lurking behind the science.
Yeah, but you can always sort of write around that.
So is that what you find yourself doing, ignoring the politics or finding ways around that to get to the science?
Well, they're always, the science is always the most interesting part of it, because mm-hmm. the politics is always the same damn thing over and over again, mm-hmm. you know? It's like X says Y this, Y says that. But actually, I wanted to add one more thing about the balance thing, because, you know, I'm saying that a science journalist needs to lend a certain amount of expertise to their writing and say, you know, here's the deal, people. It's not, you know, he said, she said thing. But there's a caveat, because some science journalists end up believing their own sayings too much. There's one woman, there was a journalist at the New York Times who became very unpopular with scientists, because she would cover medical stories, and before she had written the story, before she had interviewed anybody, she would have the story in her mind. Here's how it is. Here's how it's laid out. This is what I think. Then she would go around and sort of take interviews and pick through the interviews for the quotes that she liked. Even if she had a two-hour interview with, you know, a scientist, and he said one thing the whole time, and then he said something that sounded like the other thing for 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. She picks that, plunks it into her story, and sort of builds her story that way. Scientists stopped taking her interviews, and people were really upset. And so, of course, the journalist needs to know that they're not, in fact, a scientist. And, sorry.
So would you say that your concerns for integrity and representing the views and thoughts of scientists is actually a more important goal than representing some sort of balance?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look at the anti-aging thing. I mean, you've got, like, every year or every 2 years, you've got, like, the secret miracle cure for aging. Like, now you can stop aging, like, because this scientist discovered a certain kind of plankton that when injected into the face, you know? And then 2 years later, you have NBC Dateline, like, Jane thought that XXX pharmaceuticals could inject plankton into her face and make her live forever. Now her skin has melted off her face. And she's like, I just want to make sure that this never happens to anyone again. And it's like this kabuki ritual, like this, like every 2 years you have like, wow, blah, no more aging. And then, you know, skin melting off the face. Okay, next. All right.
So I think we have some sense of what science writing is. Perhaps you could read some of your writing for us.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Tell us what you're going to read and then go ahead.
Okay. This is part of my thesis, my master's thesis. It continues to evolve. I wrote about nuclear waste, and I really enjoyed it. So, actually, you know what? Sorry, I have to have a drink. I've been talking too much. Okay. 10 minutes after Leyte Ferreira ate her egg sandwich for lunch, she started throwing up. She was still throwing up a day later, and so was her uncle, De Vere. Soon her Aunt Maria started vomiting, too. The family's symptoms got worse. Vomiting and diarrhea were followed by strange aches and burns. 2 days later, on September 21, 1987, Maria took a bus to Gania's public health clinic, where the doctor dismissed her case as food poisoning. Maria's mother came to the house to help the family, and soon she was also sick. Lesions crept over their skin and their hair fell out. In later interviews, the family's neighbors told investigators they thought the family had AIDS. A week later, Maria returned to the health clinic with a small plastic bag full of what looked like iridescent blue salt, insisting that this substance was the cause of the family's illness. The doctor dismissed her as superstitious and uneducated and had Maria admitted to the local tropical diseases hospital. But he did move the bag to the courtyard outside his office. During the previous 2 weeks, several people had been admitted to the hospital as well with Maria's symptoms. Nausea, diarrhea, vertigo, and mysterious skin lesions. Doctors had attributed the problem to a common tropical disease, but another physician at the clinic soon began to suspect radiation poisoning. He called the Brazilian Atomic Energy Commission to have the mysterious bag tested by a health physicist. When the health physicist checked the radiation levels at the clinic, he noticed that his meter was broken. The needle kept returning preposterously high readings no matter where he pointed the detector. When he came back to the clinic later with a new meter, it showed identical results. At that point, the health physicist realized that he was dealing with a major contamination. Luckily, he had returned just in time to thwart the fire marshal's plan of disposing of the bag by throwing it into a nearby river. 2 days after Maria's fateful trip, 112,000 people found themselves in Gianni's Olympic Stadium, clustered in haphazard lines at hastily constructed tents to be tested for radiation poisoning. Goiânia is the capital of the state of Goiás in central Brazil. The city sprawls out from a center dominated by skyscrapers, surrounded by a moat of one-story homes and streets lined with tropical fruit trees. About 1.2 million people live there. Some of the many parks still have monkeys. In 1971, IGR, a local cancer treatment clinic, bought a radiation therapy machine that uses a radioactive isotope called cesium-137. IGR left Goiânia in 1985. After 14 years, their machine had become obsolete, so the administrators left it in the abandoned clinic. They notified neither the Atomic Energy Commission nor the State Secretary of Health of the hazardous radioactive waste they were leaving behind. Over the next 2 years, the abandoned clinic slowly decomposed at the hands of scavengers picking it clean of anything they needed. By 1987, the clinic was barely three ramshackle walls with large holes eating through the peeling sides. Homeless people slept there. In the former treatment room, amid piles of human excrement, the still relatively intact radiological machine slumbered. Roberto dos Santos Alves and Wagner Mota made their living scavenging scrap metal and selling it to junkyards. Mota had heard that something valuable was still inside the clinic. The men brought a wheelbarrow to the dilapidated building and found the radiotherapy machine, which looks like a cross between a telescope and an enormous dentist's chair. They took apart the heavy iron assembly and wheeled the inner stainless steel canister back to De Vere Ferreira's inner-city scrap lot, where they sold it to him for about $25. When Ferreira's employees smashed the canister with a sledgehammer, they found an intriguing platinum capsule. Ernesto, one of the employees, pried it open with a screwdriver. His curiosity was met with about 3 ounces of a glowing, sparkling blue powder. The consistency was variable. Some crystals were as big as pieces of kosher salt. Most were the size of dust. They were held closely together in a crumbly cake, which Ernesto broke apart and sifted through his fingers. Witnesses later said that they remembered him calling it carnival glitter. Ernesto chose one of the bigger blue crystals to make into a ring for his wife. He put it in his right front pocket and went back to work. De Vere was convinced that the enthralling powder was worth a lot of money and even began to suspect that it might be supernatural. As rumors spread of its mystical properties, many neighbors and acquaintances came to the Ferreira house to take some of the powder. His brother dipped his finger into the sacred dust and drew a cross on his abdomen. Maria slept in bedclothes covered in the sparkly blue dust. 6-year-old Leire rubbed the powder all over her body until she glowed and sparkled. As cesium-137 decays, it emits two radioactive products, beta particles and gamma rays. Beta particles are simply electrons. Although they can damage the skin, they travel slowly and without much force. External exposure can cause a sunburn-like irritation called beta burn, but the tough cells of the skin easily block beta particles from doing any internal damage. But when the radioactive source is ingested, the story changes. The same slow travel capacity that makes beta particles so harmless outside the body makes them much more harmful inside the body, where all their energy is trapped within a tiny radius. The other product of cesium-137 decay is gamma radiation. Gamma rays are photons, just like visible light, but with about 10,000 times as much energy. Gamma rays are more penetrating than beta particles, in fact, more so than X-rays. They barely notice your skin as they glide through organs, muscle, and bone. The damage they can do depends on two things: the radioactivity of the source and how close a person is to that source. The corollary of beta burn is called a thermal gamma burn, but instead of irradiating the skin, it fries the organs inside the body. Most of the particles on Lyda's sandwich travel to her stomach, where they wreaked havoc on the stomach and intestinal cells. When she inhaled, the finer dust-sized crystals settled into the sensitive epithelial cells of her lungs, where they were quickly absorbed into the bloodstream. The particles on her skin burned her. Of the 112,000 people the commission tested at the Olympic Stadium, 249 were contaminated, 54 of them seriously enough to be flown to a hospital in Rio de Janeiro for treatment. The first task was to remove as much of the internal source as they could. When you're internally exposed, the first thing you want to do is just get it out of your body by any means necessary. You start with brute force, lavage, laxatives, chemical methods like Prussian blue. Just get whatever is inside out. Most of the 54 survived. 23 were treated for localized radiation burns, and several lost fingers. 5 required skin grafts. Ernesto, the scrapyard worker who had sifted lovingly through all 3 ounces of fairy dust, received intense thermal gamma burns on his hands and on his right thigh, where the salt grain-sized piece of cesium had burned through his pants. The men who had dismantled the machine fared badly. Mota and Alves had been exposed to large doses from the moment they moved the giant machine. Both men suffered from vomiting, diarrhea, and vertigo within days of their initial exposure, and Mota's hand was swollen and burned. Like Lyda's father, he had been initially diagnosed with a reaction to tainted food, so treatment had been delayed. 2 weeks after the Olympic Stadium tests, doctors amputated Santos Alvo's right arm below the elbow, but he later died. On October 29th, 2 of De Vere's other workers, Israel Batista dos Santos and Admilson Alves de Souza, died of internal hemorrhaging. For Lyda and her Aunt Maria, the only care the hospital could offer was palliative. Lyda was ravaged by massive infections. She only lived for a month. She and Maria died on the same day. Lyda was buried in a lead coffin sealed with concrete. Environmental decontamination efforts started immediately, but the contamination had already spread. All the tools used to open the cylinder were contaminated. The bus stop where Maria waited with the bag of powder was contaminated, the doctor's office at the health clinic, and the clothes worn by the staff who touched the bag. The radioactive material was scattered by children playing in the scrapyard and by the workers who took the powder home to their families. Trying to get medical help, the Ferreras and their workers contaminated 3 medical practices and 5 hospitals. Every contaminated person who drove to a hospital contaminated a car. The dust tainted 5 pigs, 23 chickens, 3 buses, 14 cars, and 50,000 rolls of toilet paper. The emergency response team sent to assist at the hospital in Rio de Janeiro had been inadequately trained to deal with the skin lesions, illnesses, and death. Hospital staff rebelled because they were afraid of being contaminated themselves, which left a skeleton crew of emergency workers. The understaffed hospital left seriously injured patients unattended for days at a time. Some tried to escape by throwing themselves out of windows. An official certificate was required to leave the state, stating that the resident had not been contaminated. Roadblocks were set up at borders. Though 8,000 residents got the certificate, their cars were stoned at the border. Bus drivers refuse to let Guyana residents board. Pilots refuse to fly planes with Guyana residents on the passenger manifest. Relatives of people left homeless by the contamination turned them away. Hotels in other cities refused to take them in. The citizens were also unwilling to let the state bury the bodies of Lyda Maria and the workers. After her death, Lyda's body was still emitting about 5 times the dose sufficient to kill a person. Even though lead and concrete encased her coffin, protesters threw stones at Lyda's casket during her funeral. In 16 days, 3 ounces of cesium chloride became a citywide contamination, a long-term public health threat, a political and economic catastrophe, and 13.5 tons of nuclear waste. The end.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I can't help noticing that there's a bit of a story arc to that,
mm-hmm.
and there are characters,
mm-hmm.
and there's also a lot of information about radiation poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess 2 questions. First of all, is this use of story arc and characters a thing you expect to find in fiction writing? Did you find that your background in fiction writing influenced the way that you approach science writing?
Mm-hmm.
And is this something that you often use in your writing?
Yeah, I mean, in this one, I think it works better because the story was sort of already out there. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that this is something that happened to people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that it was pretty dramatic. You know, she died. You know, I didn't make that up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was... That's an extreme case of what I try to do,
mm-hmm.
Which is to identify a character. You know, if you can figure out... like, and it doesn't have to be a person. You know, it can be nuclear waste. It can be a multi-gate transistor. It can be, you know, whatever it is, you just have to make sure that it becomes the center of your story. And then I think you can tell an interesting story about a thing without manufacturing controversy or without sort of sensationalizing, mm-hmm. because you have a thing around which to sort of build your mm-hmm. your story. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just a random collection of facts milling around, and nobody wants to read that.
Right. Yeah, so I think it does. I think you're right that having the story arc, the character, does make it more engaging. I wonder what your thoughts are on whether or not this makes it more accessible. And one part of your story that you left out here,
mm-hmm.
which I'll read, is the story of cesium.
Oh, no. My sidebar.
Yeah, where you say most people prefer a stable existence to a volatile and unpredictable one. Elements are not exempt from this rule. To say an element is radioactive is to say it is undergoing constant change. Its atoms are constantly throwing off electrons. They do this because they are looking for a rest state, the most stable form of themselves. This process is called radioactive decay. And like confused teenagers, highly radioactive elements will go through several identities before they settle on their stable identity. So I have absolutely no interest in cesium-137 and probably wouldn't follow along on a description of radioactive decay, and yet I feel myself drawn into this. Because you are anthropomorphizing cesium.
Mm-hmm.
It is becoming your character.
Yeah. I mean, that's good and bad. I mean, it's good because people will, of course, always read something that's anthropomorphized, but you mm-hmm. can only go so far. I think
mm-hmm.
a physicist would take issue with that, just in terms of, like, how simplified it is.
Right.
So you always have to sort of walk this very delicate balance between making it interesting and making shit up. So, and that's, you know, you kind of have to do both because you can't, you know, you can't make it too boring, but yeah. Delicate negotiation. And then, you know, source review. We do source review at IEEE Spectrum, and that's always great because then I get to read stuff like that to the physicists and they get to say, what are you talking about? And then I get to convince them, no, this is the only way anybody will read this. So they're complicit.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the commonalities between literary writing, fiction writing, and science writing,
mm-hmm.
I thought you might treat us to a glimpse of your past and read us maybe a little bit of your fiction writing.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think I should definitely read something I wrote when I was 21. All right, this is going to be very short. Okay. It's called Terminal. The Manhasset lunatic is on board the Long Island Railroad again, yelling at the advertisements on the wall. At least he doesn't ask anyone for anything, Emma thinks. Not like the lady that gets on sometimes at Penn Station, face purple and swollen. I was just robbed, she calls out shrilly. Somebody beat the shit out of me and took my purse. Can anybody find it in their hearts to lend me $5 to get home? Emma remembers that from high school. In 9th grade, commuting home, she gave the woman money. In 10th grade, she called out, why don't you go to station police? The train stops at the platform. Last stop, New York Penn Station. The conductor's voice crackles across the bad speaker like wrapping paper. Please take a moment to locate your belongings. Have a good holiday, folks. It's almost 5 o'clock, and the commuters are pressed up against the doors, which should have opened by now. Emma hates this delay, almost more on their behalf than on her own. She remembers what it was like to be stuck all the way in the front, squashed against the side of the train, hordes of businessmen and women and janitors and teachers and telemarketers all itching to get home, and everyone just giving it one more little squeeze. A goggle-eyed woman is squashed like a bug against the plexiglass, and Emma tries not to look at her breasts, flattened like against the glass like a little kid making window faces. She doesn't mind the crush. She's used to it. It makes her feel like at home, kind of insulated. People refer to it as a mad rush, but it isn't. There's nothing hysterical about a flock of New Yorkers trying to leave the city. This isn't like the subway, binging and purging on frantic tourists. Quietly, grimly, they edge into every available space, strategizing their path to the door. They plow forward, heads down, Reeboks and nylons and briefcases and au bon pain cups, and the giddy high school kids are the only ones talking. The train doors open and let out the trickle of about 10 people commuting against the grain. Before Emma is out, they plunge in. She sees a few Chapin skirts and too much dark lipstick and gets momentarily nostalgic. The Manhasset lunatic is still in his rumpled business suit. I'm an ad exec, he crows and flaps his empty briefcase hanging open. Out of my way, goddammit! The Amtrak terminals are one floor above the Long Island Railroad, a kinder, gentler universe. Emma walks to the public phones and checks her watch. Hey, Mom, she says after 2 rings. I'm at Tina's. I'll be home tomorrow night. I'll make dinner. The train is on time. Emma feels contained and controlled, watching the people around her closely. She enjoys disliking them. A squat woman in a fur coat clacks past in loud heels, and her swinging carry-on smacks a tall black woman's shoulder. The black woman, a slender glamazon with a shaved head, raises one disdainful eyebrow. My God, announces a woman behind Emma. It's like survival of the fittest. Emma watches the black woman cut the fur-coated one off at the escalator. On the way down, New York throws one last ad her way. Nail your boss, it says, next to a picture of a tie with a mean-looking nail stuck through it. Report software piracy, and offers the weary traveler a telephone number. It's not even toll-free.
Thank you.
Sure.
So it's a really vivid image of Penn Station, and I wonder, looking back on that now, if...
Yeah, it's totally dated Reeboks. Well, actually, wait, did those come back in? That's like 10 years ago. Okay, go ahead.
Well, in any case, do you find that, you know, looking back on that, it's... it was easier for you to perhaps create a vivid image of something like Penn Station as opposed to cesium-137? Or do you find that it's just as easy to create vivid images of science as you do Penn Station?
Well, yes and no. You know, I was in Penn Station when I was growing up. I commuted from Long Island into the city, into New York City for school, and so I saw Penn Station like twice a day, every day, my whole life for 4 years. So when you're sort of exposed to something like that, you sort of learn to recognize how it breathes, you know? So you can't do that unless you really immerse yourself into a topic. So I think the more I'm going to be writing about solid-state transistor, I mean, multi-gate transistors and regular transistors and interconnects, the more I'll be able to sort of get to know it, understand what it's like, what it looks like. That's actually the thing. I think vivid images, when you're writing about science, you have to paint a picture. You have to paint it before the reader paints the picture in his head, because if you wait too long, he's going to have a very vivid mental picture, and everything you say from then on will confuse the person, because they'll be like, well, wait, I thought it looked like this. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you do is really, like, layer by layer, dismantle the transistor, show how the interconnects are, you know, basically electroplated into the glass. You know, it's you know, more elegant language than that, obviously, but
sure.
You have to paint the picture.
Well, tell us how you do immerse yourself into something. So, you know, I take it that you have to do quite a bit of educating yourself on the topics that you're going to write about.
Yes.
And that you really do have to immerse yourself in that. So tell us about that. How do you do that? How do you learn the science that inevitably you will write about?
Wikipedia. I'm not kidding.
Okay. I assume it doesn't end there, though.
No. So the first thing I do is I download the paper, whatever paper it is that I'm writing about.
Sure.
And usually it's filled 90% with words I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And then I wiki those words. And actually the best thing about wiki is it has a terrible reputation for some reason. But the more arcane the subject, the more perfectly correct wiki is. Mm-hmm. And you can count on it. It's like a buddy. And so I spend probably a few days poring through the paper, trying to understand it. You know, I'm not going to ever understand it completely, but I do want to get the dumb questions out of the way so that I don't waste the scientist's time when I finally talk to him. I read the background, I read the press release, and then I come up with, you know, my questions, which they arise naturally once you've sort of figured out what the topic is.
Mm-hmm. So your interview is a matter of answering your own questions, mm-hmm. which are probably the questions that a lay audience would have.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I have to say one thing. I did this whole process, went through three things. I was writing an article about IBM's air gap technology, where they actually pack their integrated circuits with vacuum in between the wires instead of what they've been using before, because it's the perfect insulator. So I called the guy up, and I start asking him questions, and all of a sudden he interrupts me, and he says, you know, there's an excellent source for answers to all of this. He said, have you heard of Wikipedia? So, yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Well, let's back up for a second. Why don't you tell us how you choose the topics that you're going to write on? So you mentioned that you tend to write on papers that were published in journals. So do you pore through the journals, or how
yeah.
do you choose the papers that you're going to write about?
Well, I mean, there's so many journals, obviously, you can't
sure.
keep tabs on all of them. So that's why you specialize as a science writer, so that you start to become familiar with the field. So that when press releases come your way, I'm also, I have email notifications for every press release and every stupid thing that happens in the entire world of, you know, defense technology, like, you know, solid state physics, unfortunately. So I get a lot of press releases every day. And with time, you start to be able to read through them. It's like learning Braille. You start to be able to see the difference between, oh, this is this old thing again, and, oh, that's actually something new and interesting. So, because part of what we do, it's not just, we don't just report, like, that's important, but I think as science writers, you also have to interpret. You have to link whatever it is that just happened with the rest of the, you know, web of whatever that field is, and figure out, this is again where you say to people, hey, this is actually important. I know this because I have to spend, you know, 80 hours a week staring at press releases. Yeah, so that's usually how I do it. I'm assigned stories a lot, so mm-hmm. sometimes they're beyond my control.
Sure.
I wrote a story about 60 gigahertz technology that I would in no way have mm-hmm. pursued myself.
Sure.
So, yeah, but the good ones are, you know, and then as soon as you start to write, you know, sort of, when you're really interested in something, you, of course, you know, report it very thoroughly, write about it well, and then your editor says, well, that was good, I'll do that again. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a cycle.
Sure.
So.
So after you choose your topic and go to Wikipedia and mm-hmm. interview some mm-hmm. scientists, mm-hmm. What's the rest of your writing process like? Let me put the question this way. One of our writing consultants here at the Writing Studio claims that writers fall into one of two categories. There are the eekers, who are people whose thoughts come very slowly.
Yeah.
And most of the work is in generating the words. And then mm-hmm. once the words are on the page, there's not much that needs to happen in the way of editing. And then on the other side, you have gushers, which are people who just let the ideas come forth, and then there's all of this stuff that they have to go back and edit and turn into something. Do you find yourself falling into one of these divides? Are you somewhere in the middle?
Are you an Eaker?
I'm definitely an Eaker.
I've always been very jealous of that. I'm really I'm so envious of Eakers because I'm sick of my process, frankly. You know where the when a sculptor susses the statue out of the rock.
Yeah.
It's a very elegant metaphor,
mm-hmm.
but first you have to barf out the rock.
I see.
So I write 5,000 words, 4,250 of them are wrong.
Sure.
And I have to figure out which 750 are right.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it's basically it's an excruciating process of first I write down everything I know. And some nice sentences are in there. Some are too flowery. Some are horrible metaphors. I'm really bad at metaphors. I once tried to describe a FinFET transistor, the electrons tunneling through it, as a dog burrowing under a chain link fence. My editor almost killed me. And actually that's why you edit your own stuff, because eventually you become incredibly embarrassed to hand in certain things to somebody that you really respect. So you try to minimize their pain as much as you can.
Sure. So after you barfed out the rock, how do you find the story arc? Is it just something that strikes you, or do you have to actively search for it?
Actively search for it. Because, I mean, there's so many ways that it could go sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's so many things going on, and they have implications for so many things. You think, well, what's the part that's going to make this, like, what's the story going to be in here? Sometimes I'm actually struggling with that with a story I'm writing right now, which is about something extraordinarily boring, but it has really interesting applications for, like, downloading rental movies.
Cool.
So I think that was maybe just my desperate attempt not to, like, fall into a coma while writing the story. And finally, like, sometimes, yeah, it does sort of hit you, like, oh, wait, this could really X, and then off you go, and then it becomes really easy. Sometimes it's just really hard, and that's when you start just painting pictures, because then, you know,
sure.
Draw people pretty little pictures, move on.
So one thing that we talked about before the interview that I was hoping you might be able to do is maybe show us something that you're in the middle of. Give us a glimpse of something you're in the middle of.
Well, see, I wasn't sure how quite that would play out, because what I'm in the middle of, like, if I read it, it doesn't actually...
Sure.
make any sense at all. It's just basically collections of sentences, none of which... My main problem when I write is that everything's in the wrong order. My mentor, Anne Finkbeiner, used to say, Sally, in this world, paragraphs have a certain order and the sentences in them have a certain order. You have to find them. So, because, yeah, that's most of my editing work. So, you know, you just imagine any story that you've ever read sort of jumbled up like a word jumble with all the sentences in the wrong place and all the paragraphs in the wrong place, and that's my first draft.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the second draft like?
Slightly less tortured, much shorter, and with an actual good first paragraph.
Right on.
Then the third graph has, the third draft has a pretty good first and second paragraph. The fourth draft has a pretty good first, second, and third paragraph. And every time I go through an edition, or a revision rather, the first paragraph gets, like, polished to a gleam.
Mm-hmm.
And the second paragraph gets polished a little bit. Third paragraph gets, like, written for the first time. And so by the time I hand something in, you've got this awesome first paragraph. And if you get all the way to the last paragraph, you'll be like, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's because that's the one that has received the least. It's kind of like combing the tangles out of your hair.
Sure. Well, we're talking about editing your own work. Maybe you'll tell us what it's like to edit other people's work or have your work edited by other people. I know you do some editing at IEEE Spectrum.
Well, having your work edited by other people is amazing. Like, I think that, you know, it's definitely... The first time I was edited, I was really offended because in track changes, it was all red. It was all red. I was just like, was there anything? Was there a sentence that was right? Mm-hmm. Every one of the 750 words was the wrong one, apparently. But, you know, you start to understand, like, once you sort of get into your editor's head a little bit and always, always ask them to explain in excruciating detail, they're happy to do it, and it helps you a lot. And, you know, this happens a few times, and then you start to see a little bit less red. My paragraphs are still always rearranged, and my sentences. But, you know, the editing process, I think, is really helpful. But editing other people's stuff is more helpful. Mm-hmm. Because, for one thing, you know, you're scared to death. Because, I mean, I haven't done that much editing. But usually when I do, it's somebody who knows a lot more about the subject than I do. So, you know, I'm terrified to change things lest they be wrong. But then you start to notice that, you know, everybody does make the same mistakes. Sometimes you start to say, well, wait a second, this paragraph is completely in the wrong place. How could they put it in such a bad order? Plop it at the front. And then the more you do these things, the more you start to see the mistakes that you're making in your own work. So the next time I'm writing, you know, a story that's all in the wrong order, I'm like, wait a second, this is just what I criticized this last person's piece for doing. Like, here I am doing it. So it does help you tremendously, but it's harrowing because...
In addition to helping you become a better editor of your own paper, does being an editor help you relinquish control to somebody else, maybe give up your ego, your attachment to your own work?
Well, the way I circumvent that... Actually, I have a joke. This is sort of related to the story. It's an answer to your question. So... I'm sorry, it's at the expense of the philosophy department.
That's quite all right.
So the dean of the physics department goes to the dean of the school. He says, all right, here's my list of demands. We need new telescopes. We need 600 new, you know, state-of-the-art computers. We need, you know, everything. So he makes this very impressive list of technology that he needs. And the dean of the school puts his forehead in his hands and he says, this happens every year. He says, why can't you be more like the math department? They need pencils, paper, and a wastebasket. Actually, the philosophy department, they don't even need the wastebasket. So the reason I tell that is because I, unfortunately, am in love with every one of my drafts, no matter how awful they are. Horrible, horrible drafts. Yeah. So what I've done, instead of keeping this crap, is I have in any... store, under any store, you have a folder called drafts. Mm. When you look in there, there are like 600 documents, and they're titled like November 1st, you know, 3 a.m., November 1st, 3:01 a.m. So, like, every time I make a change, I'm like, oh, but wait a minute, what if it was better the last time? Oh. So then, you know, eventually I get somewhere, and then I get to throw away all the old drafts. But yeah, so, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to relinquish ownership or your ego, but... Mm-hmm. I work around it by just fooling myself into thinking I'll keep everything that I've written.
I see. In my own defense, I do throw away lots of
I know. It was totally unfair. I'm sorry.
One other thing that you do at Spectrum, other than writing and editing, is blogging. And I was surprised to find out that serious journalists would blog. Mm-hmm. I guess I assumed that journalists would look down on blogging as being something less... but it's actually part of Spectrum's electronic format. How do you see the connection between your work as a blogger, your work as a science writer, a writer of actual articles?
Well, first of all, you said earlier, like, serious journalists versus bloggers. I mean, serious journalists, bloggers are serious journalists. Mm. This is all part of, I mean, I don't know. This is all part of the evolution of the magazine business, right? Mm-hmm. So if anybody here goes into the magazine business, you're going to hear, until you want to vomit, you're going to hear about how dead tree is dead and, like, you know, everything's going to be moving to the internet and blah, 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 which is not true because people still want to carry around a magazine and stuff it into their, like, bag or whatever to read on the plane. So, but there's this big debate right now about what's going to happen with magazines. And right now, what it's looking like is that daily content isn't really that important to be printed on paper. So you're going to have, you know, your monthly publication, but it's going to be more news analysis than news. Obviously, you can't have cutting-edge news if you've got something that's published once a month. So you've got sort of news analysis, very carefully crafted features, and then on a daily basis, you've got like a website that's updated once a day. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know for myself, like, I don't like to go to a magazine that I like and see the same stale content every single time that I go there.
Sure.
And people just get more and more greedy for this. Like, my favorite blog is Wired's Danger Room. Mm-hmm. So good. Anyway, but I go there, and, like, I'm a little obsessive. Like, I want to see the new thing, and there's always a new thing, so I keep going. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of this pull, and we're trying to do that at Spectrum, too. So, and, you know, the blog is almost, like, immediate, like, reporting, and you also get this, like, real-time interaction with people that you don't get at all if you're writing in print. You know, like in print, you know, you write a letter. You write an article. I wrote one in September about, you know, the new energy department, Advanced Research Project Agency. 2 months later, I get a letter to the editor that's like, I really enjoyed blah, blah, blah. But like the better part, I think, is writing these things, writing blog posts and getting these real time responses, even if they're a little bit abusive and informal. It's just much more, like, you really, it's very visceral. You get a real sense of, like, is this a story? Like, and then they give you, some of the commenters at Danger Room, they're very sharp, they're very plugged in, they're reading it. Like, Danger Room covered the Blackwater scandal in a way that rarely any magazine did. Like, it was just this real-time, constant updating. You have to see it. And even the commenters were more intelligent than, you know, most of the people writing about it at the time elsewhere.
So really, the commenters you get to your blog posts are an indication of who your audience is, mm-hmm. and what the pressing issues are.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Very interesting.
I suck at blogging, though, unfortunately.
I have one last question about your relationship to your own writing. Mm. You, of course, write in English,
mm-hmm.
and to hear you speak perfect English, but English is not your first language.
No.
And unlike most speakers of English, you actually remember the way in which you learned English.
Yes.
And I wonder if your initial encounter with English shaped the way that you write today.
That's a tough question to answer. I came to the States in 1983, and I was, like, fresh off the plane, in fact. And the day after I got off the plane, my mom sent me to summer camp on Long Island, which was excruciating, because I don't know if anybody's been to Long Island, but the larvae of the people on Long Island. This is a podcast? Okay, so anyway. Sorry.
Mention that you are a Long Island native, and that
yes.
You're only ridiculing yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm allowed to do that. Anyway, so it was harrowing. I knew the word orange and the word clock, but I didn't know how to use them in context very well. So I ran around saying, like, "What clock is it? What clock is it?" Because that's the transliteration in German. You say "Wie viel Uhr ist es?" which is "What clock is it?" And, you know, I was like the little Simpsons German kid. And, you know, that didn't make me have many friends. But, you know, I guess there is a certain desperation to be understood that maybe made me much more inclined to try to use exact words, try to be as exact as I could be in communicating things, because it was so frustrating to sort of sit there mutely and, you know, be unable to answer anything.
Sure. Well, why don't we open the floor to some questions and see if anybody has any questions for you.
Okay.
I'll let you take your own questions.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
What length are the deadlines usually, and how do you access interviews?
How do you mean access?
Like, how do you get people to give you interviews?
Oh, actually, that's something that I wanted to say that I forgot to say. How do I get people to give me interviews? I call them, and they... Like, that's the thing about being a science writer. I think it's one of the best jobs in the world, just because on a daily basis, you talk to people who are so in love with their work and love so much what they do. It's this infectious enthusiasm, and it's every single day. And it's every single day somebody's like, this is so cool. And they always want to talk to you. They always explain to you 50 times. I mean, I would be like punching somebody in the face through the phone, but they're still like super patient. So, I mean, in terms of interviews, all you have to do, even as a student, is call and be like, tell me about your work. And they do it, which I still find mind-boggling. Like, I think it's really cool. Defense, obviously, is quite different. You have to hunt those people down with, like, a bow and arrow. but the Oregon. And so the deadlines for news pieces, they can be like horrible, like a day. And then for some features, they can be like 4 months. It's variable. It depends on what your editor needs. It depends on like the timeliness of the story. If you're working on something, so you're crafting some piece lovingly, and then all of a sudden like somebody leaks information, all of a sudden you have to just have it immediately. So it depends. News usually really fast turnover. Features usually pretty good long time. Go ahead.
These days, I think more people tend to get into science writing through the science side.
Mm-hmm.
To get a science degree and go over. But you've gone the opposite way.
Yeah.
English and over. So I wonder, was it that got you hooked into science writing? Was there any event or crucial moment that made you make that switch?
Yes. I read a book by a guy named John Barrow at Oxford. He's a theoretical physicist, and it was called The Book of Nothing. And this is kind of existential, whatever, angsty thing, but I had always had a very sort of tremendous fear of death because of the idea of nothing. Like, I thought the idea of nothingness was so absurd, like that, and kind of insulting to sort of the human condition or whatever, or not the human condition, to me in particular. and just, you know, all of this, and then it just ends, and then it's done, and it's just nothing. And then, you know, I used to freak myself out about it, actually, even when I was, like, little. I would lie in my bed and think about nothing and space and, you know, have to, like, hold on to the sides of my bed. But then I read this book, and he's talking about nothing, and he's talking about the history of zero. He's talking about how it's a purely human conception, like the idea of making nothing into a something that we call zero or nothing. And he was talking about sort of, you know, the sort of what is nothing? Like, if you can't define it, then you can't even talk about it or think about it. So it blew my mind. And it was science writing. I mean, he was writing about theoretical physics. He was writing about math. I couldn't believe that I was, like, ripping through a book about math. And I think that's when I was really just, I was sort of blown away, and I realized that some of the most interesting things people write about aren't, you know, chick lit and, you know, relationship books and things like that. It's actually math and science, you know. Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
I'm an electrical engineer. There's several of us here.
Mm-hmm.
So I get Spectrum, and it sits,
I'm glad you like
it. Sits in my bathroom. You
know? Yes.
And so
I think that's a common position for
well,
the magazine.
So,
it's our centerfold. Sorry.
I had a friend stay with me who is a non-technical guy. He's a musician, and he's working in human relations in a hospital or something. He started reading Spectrum, and he said to me, "Hey, this is really pretty interesting. You know, I don't know what this is. I never heard of this stuff before, but I kind of like it." And I'm so he sat in the bathroom a long time and read it. So that's just a comment that I think Spectrum actually succeeds in reaching the two audiences. You know, I like it.
Thanks. That's good.
And I have a anecdotal case that other people like it too.
Yeah. We're a very well-kept secret, to put it that way. Because whenever I say, you know, I work for a magazine that you've never heard of, and then they say, well, what is it? I say, IEEE Spectrum, and either it's this, or it's, oh, Spectrum, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's 90% the one and 10% the other. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Are you familiar with John Franklin's work?
Yes.
Do you ever write stories about science that involve the personal and the process and all those kind of things in addition to just what they figured out? Feature stories? Like
I haven't yet. I'm still sort of on a restricted beat. I think that's really for... No, I think it's a good process, but so far I've just been painting pretty pictures. So... I hope to do so in the future,
yeah,
actually.
I think his Pulitzer Prizes are for telling science like a story, sort of like a novel. It sounds like you have some of the background that would lead you to go in that direction.
I hope so.
Writing, then you know, you're going to take those same, you're going to use those same techniques, but you're going to write nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
it's going to be fun to read because it's a story about people.
Yeah.
As opposed to a story about thin films or air gap, whatever. Although that'll come out in the story.
You know, it's sad. My editors always chop out the color I put in about, you know, the people. But, you know, that's just because it's probably not very good.
I don't understand that. I mean, they must be institutionalized.
No. It's because we only have... I appreciate that. But I think that the length of stories is... it prohibits... You're sort of choosing either to make it a sort of down-home folksy piece about, you know, this scientist, you know, who's very quirky and tootling around in his lab, or you make sure that you get into the science of it. And sometimes the word count is, you know, it's sort of one or the other. You know, I sometimes manage to sneak one thing in, but often not.
Well, Spectrum doesn't do feature stories. They just do music stuff.
Yeah, no, they do. We do. We are like Scientific American in the sense that we even have expert authored features. So we call these people up. I'm working on one right now with a DARPA neuroscientist about something called accelerated learning, which is probably one of the most interesting subjects out there right now. Operational neuroscience, it seeks to marry neuroscience and engineering, which is just as scary as it sounds. So
this sounds like making people super geniuses in moments?
Yes, and actually they took a poll at a university and 80% of university students said that they would have no problem with somebody just poking around in their head if it would make them smarter. So,
how many people here would like that? To all of a sudden be an accelerated
Yeah, all of a sudden
learner.
You understand everything in whatever the class is that's giving the
yeah,
biggest pain in your head.
Let's take an informal poll. I'm interested. It's only about 50-50. I guess some of us are cautious about having our heads poked around.
Right, because of course then there's some guy was saying that probably one of the side effects would be persistent traumatic memories that you can't get rid of.
Sure.
Six of one.
Any other questions?
Question. You said that you sucked as a blogger. I was wondering if you could comment on that as a particular writing genre or why you suck as a blogger.
I don't give it enough time. And I think, you know, I don't know what to write about. Like, I'm writing my stories, but, you know, on the one hand, like, I don't want to... I don't know what to write about. Like, when I've gone to conferences, I blogged DARPA Tech 2007, and that was one of the most awesome experiences of my life. I saw this, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, you know, the internet, whatever, but they're always working on really crazy stuff. Like, they were working on here at Vanderbilt, part of that is happening, right? The rocket-powered arm.
Yeah.
Tell us about this. I'm confused. I still don't understand what DARPA is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Robotic arm has to do with it.
The Defense Department has an Advanced Research Projects Agency where it throws money at things that you would be like, yeah, sure, okay. Like, they wanted by 2009 to create a fully functional and like super a bionic arm. They wanted to create for soldiers that are returning from Iraq, missing their limbs. They want to not give them the best years of our lives claw. Mm-hmm. They want to give them something that actually works. So
is this conference where people come
everybody
and sell
does,
their wares
yeah.
and
It's
and
not
try
sell.
To
they're showing each other their project in
I
the
see.
Hopes that like nobody there were like five journalists there. It's not journalists. It was 4,000 people and all of them were government contractors or university people. Etc. I had a blood orange badge to alert people to the fact that I was a journalist. I felt like a leper. People would be like, journalist. So, but the exhibits were so cool. This guy Jesse Sullivan. He's an electrician who lost both his arms in a. I guess he touched a transformer or something. He lost his arms over the shoulder. He's wearing this prosthetic thing, and I was skeptical. I was just like, yeah, this is going to be another one of those like grip claw things. And so he's wearing it, and he is moving his hand in such a way, so sort of elegantly, delicately, and mindlessly, that I started to have this weird cognitive dissonance where it wasn't pretty. Like, it wasn't covered with skin or even something that looked like skin. It was just blue stuff and metal. But he's moving it in such a way that I was completely convinced in the back of my brain that he had an actual arm under there and he was wearing a robot suit. Like, it was so crazy because he was doing these very sort of delicate movements, and they're working on something that makes what happens is they're plugged into the residual muscles in the spinal column, so they're working on pressure sensitive appendages. So I squeezed the tip of his finger, and he said he felt it, which is crazy. It's a robot arm, you know. It was just so amazing. So I blogged that, and apparently that was very successful. It got on Dig or whatever, but everything since then has been an abject failure. Nobody reads my blogs, and they're really boring. Nobody should. So unless I'm somewhere really interesting, I don't have very much to say.
Right. So did you find the blogging about the DARPA conference that came easier because you were painting these pictures of things that were...
Well, yeah. I mean, I had just interesting things going on at all times. And, like, all I did was... I couldn't even blog the number of things that I saw that I thought were fascinating. It was total, like, information overload. Everything was so cool. So, yeah, I'm a little bit of a fangirl for DARPA, unfortunately. So... Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Two-part question. Collaborators and sourcing. Do you have colleagues that you help, that you workshop drafts with or that read drafts for you? And have you ever had any issues with sourcing in terms of either... somebody that you interviewed or a source that you had to use and that there were any difficulties with that?
So the first thing, we all have, for our features, second readers and reader advocates on staff, which I think is really cool. So when we do our feature meetings, our big monthly meetings, you know, we have, the person proposes their feature, and then people say, yes, you know, you can write this. And then somebody who is an expert in that area on staff or whatever, the best approximation thereof, is assigned to be your second reader. So then they basically are going through your drafts with you. Then you have a reader advocate, and you also have an editor. So it's definitely, there are very many ways in which you get feedback. What I do actually also is my group from Johns Hopkins, where I got my master's, we're incredibly close still. And a lot of times we actually give each other our work so that we can get some other eyes on it. And that works for me really well.
So you've got formal and informal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm a little insecure sometimes about the way things, like the way that I'm presenting things. So it's nice to sometimes have somebody say, I think you should do it this way, or yeah, that's fine. The other thing, the sourcing, I was writing a story about that Energy Advanced Project Research Agency that they created this past September. And all of a sudden, a lot of the people on Capitol Hill that I talked to said, I don't want my name in this. You know, I talked to them, they were fine. And then all of a sudden they called me and they were like, I don't want to be associated with the story. So then you do a lot of negotiating. Like you say, well, how can I identify you? Can I identify you as a source who was not authorized to talk, but who works in the, you know, science and technology committee in building 308, you know, and then, you know, they're like, no. And you're like, can I identify you as a staffer in the science and technology committee? And then, you know, you sort of negotiate that. And finally, you know, an unauthorized person on the street in D.C. You know? So, yeah, it's kind of a process of negotiation after that. Go ahead.
In that, when you were reading your excerpt from your thesis, it seemed to me that the information you gathered, how you went about gathering, was as important as how you chose to present it. Can you talk a little bit about, did you go to Brazil? How did you get that information?
No, I didn't go to Brazil.
Okay.
I poured through the International Atomic Energy Association Committee, their reports on it, because they wrote this enormous report. Obviously, it's like the biggest, I think it's the biggest radiation exposure incident that has happened to date. And so there were a lot of sources about that. I read their report. I read other reports. And then, you know, in terms of the other stuff, I was taking health physics classes at Hopkins, so I asked my professor a lot of questions about how you get, you know, radioactive material out of your body, like how does an electron affect you? Well, not an electron, you know, beta particles, gamma rays. A lot of different ways of trying to figure that out. But no, I did not go to Brazil. That would have been nice.
But maybe not going to that particular part of Brazil if they're still radioactive.
They're not radioactive, but super long-term consequence, a lot of those places that are still paved over lots. Yeah. It would be interesting to go, but no.
Yeah.
expensive.
How should someone prepare for a job like this?
Are there other science writing programs?
Oh, yeah, there's gazillions of them. There's, BU has a great one. The big one, I think, is Santa Cruz. So, I mean, all you have to do is Google science writing. You'll see a lot of those. I guess preparing to go, I would say have one particular area that you're really passionate about. That would really help, because otherwise you'll be bored to death by what you're writing. They teach you a lot. If you really want to do it, I would say that you just maybe... I would say everybody should take calculus 1 through maybe 3. Just to learn how to... And physics, just to learn how to... if you're going to write about physics, if you want to do that, if you want to go that route. Just because, I sort of started to understand the beauty of integrals and, sort of the very arid beauty of physics. Even if I don't want to live there, it's nice to visit. Mm-hmm. So you should have a handle on what it is that the people that you're talking to, like what their head is shaped like inside,
Well, I'm actually doing a PhD in the sciences now, and I'm wondering how,
Oh, and that was actually a question I was going to answer for you. Yeah. A lot of people are actually, a lot of science writers are people who had PhDs, but now they just want to write about it. This one woman in the program, she was a neuroscientist this year. I can't imagine going through your 5,000 years of school, getting your PhD, and then being like, I want to be a journalist. That would suck. But this is how, your salary will really, you will not be pleased. But,
Santa Cruz is specifically for people with science degrees who want to get into science.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Where was that?
UC Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay.
Now I definitely have to erase the podcast. Johns Hopkins and Santa Cruz have this West Side Story relationship. My Anne is going to kill me. Yeah, go to Johns Hopkins. So.
But then the science, the advanced science degree would give you some kind of advantage, I would figure, over somebody who went through and got a...
No.
It's a liability rather than a...
Absolutely. You know why? Because you already know this stuff. You interview somebody, you guys talk shop. You're just like, oh, and ba-ba-da-boo, the multi-gate transistor. Oh, and what about the interconnects? Are they made of copper? Oh, great. What's the dielectric constant? Then you go and write your article for somebody like me, and you're just like, dielectric constant. It's somebody, the dumber the better, honestly. Sometimes, if you promise to erase this part of the podcast, the girl who sits in the cube next to me and I, we frequently say to each other that science writing is basically you're an expert at being an idiot. Because you call these scientists and you have to ask them ever dumber questions because that's how you get the really good explanations. Because finally, they're just like, they're so frustrated. They're like, look, it's like a cat. They're just, they try then to finally to relate to you. And a lot of times, if you can't grasp something, you have to make them come to you. You have to make them, make that effort. And sometimes that's your only hope of writing an interesting article. So, honestly, there's one particular writer, and she, it seems like she is dumb as a post. She writes the most amazing articles because she asks these questions I didn't know Hubble was in space. And she gets these articles that you're just like, you just rip through them and you read them because they're so interesting. And there's never a hiccup where you're just like, I don't understand that. Because everything is in total lay terms, beautiful writing, and perfect, really.
Well, let me give you this advice. We at the writing studio are pretty dumb. We don't know anything about science, at least, and we're always happy to work with you on your writing. So come here often. Any other questions? Okay, so let's end there. The conversation can continue. We have a reception set up, so I hope you do stick around and have some food and continue the chatting. Thanks for coming.